HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Welcome to the Investor Hour podcast. I'm your host, Rahul Goyal. The goal of this podcast is to learn from the best investment minds of our times. We want to learn their backstory, essentially, what makes them, them. We want to learn how they make their decisions in their personal lives. And of course, we want to learn about their core principles of investing. Essentially, a lot of learning that could help you make better decisions in life and investing. This week, we continue our conversation with Ajit Dayal, founder, Quantum Mutual Fund, Personal FN, and Equity Master. We start off with Ajit's meeting with Narayan Murthy before the IPO of Infosys. And then we delve into Ajit's philosophy of investing, which has been tested time and again over the last 30 plus years. So Ajit, last time we left off, we spoke about the whole story of BITV. And then you were starting to tell us about the Infosys IPO and Narayan Murthy, etc. So yeah, so we are all ears. I think that's a story that's not been told to many people. And we'd love to know. We all know there was an IPO which kind of devolved, and you know, the rest is history. But it'll be great to get the role you played in it and your interactions and what you felt at that point in time.
Sure. So at the time, there were a bunch of companies doing pre-IPO placements, including one infamous one called Namaste Exports, which we were also investors in. That was a time when Jardine Fleming and Quantum had a joint venture. And one of the things that I was doing at the joint venture, my last role in the joint venture, was to set up the asset management side. So we had three largish funds, one in Hong Kong called the Jardine Fleming India Hong Kong Trust, one in UK called the Flemings India Trust, and one in New York called the Jardine Fleming India Growth Fund. And all these three funds were basically pretty much the same portfolio investing into India. And I was helping the fund manager make those investments. So at that point in time, I think up to 5% or 10% of our total NAV, of the total AUM, could be invested in unlisted shares or in companies that were about to do an IPO, kind of a pre-placement sort of stuff, where I think you could hold it for 12 or 18 months, something like that. So we got a call from Enam to meet this company called Infosys. So I went down to Bangalore to meet them. And that time they had their office in Koramangala, which is where the first office was, I guess, in Bangalore. And so I met Mr. Narayan Murthy, and, you know, I was 32 years old then. So 1992, 93, I was 32 years old then. And Mr. Narayan Murthy, you know, took me around the office very sweetly, ground floor, first floor, second floor, very old structure. And trying to explain to me, you know, the software. Now, I had actually brought in an Apple IIe into India when I left the US in 1984 to use when I was in India. So I knew a little bit about computers, but really, you know, not a techie per se, but that's about it. And I remember seeing this one door, one room which he had. I think it was green or white, was the base of the room, maybe 3 feet high. Steel rim, and then you had this mirror, or not mirror, glass, and then you had these, you know, padlocks, like chains, locking the door with this big Godrej, thick brass steel lock, whatever. And behind that was like a laptop with a pole and a wire kind of running up that pole. And so I asked him, so he was showing me around the office, I asked him, you know, what's behind that door? He said, oh, that's a PC, that is the computer we use for GE. So I said, GE USA. He said, yeah, GE USA. I said, what do you do for them? He said, oh, they send us things every evening, their time, kind of early morning, late night, our time. And then we process them. And then through that wire, we send it back to them so that when they wake up in the morning, they have something else, extra work has been done. I said, oh, that's interesting. I said, is it profitable? He said, well, yeah, they pay us well, but, you know, we have to pay MTNL, I think it was 12 lakh of rupees a year. That's a lakh rupees a month for a 28 and 56 kbps line. Now, for many of the generational, you know, people who don't know what a kbps, I think it stands for kilobytes per second or something like that. So fractions of gigabytes and fractions of everything else we're used to today. And, you know, like 1 lakh rupees a month. I said, and on the other side of the equation, we had invested in Bharti Airtel making push button phones. And those push button phones, that business was valued at 6 times or 8 times P multiple in the market, something like that. And they had a license from the government for setting up mobile telephone networks in India. And that was in a joint venture with an Italian company called STET, S-T-E-T. And so, you know, when we had met Bharti on the other side, Sunil Mittal and his team on the other side, he said, oh, you know, we're going to do mobile networks. You know, what exactly is mobile phones? You know, I'm not a techie guy, BA economics, MBA, and not one of those brilliant IIT people. So he said, no, we're going to bring down the cost and reach of telephones because we don't need copper wires to have lines and just be signals. Okay. But, you know, he said he's going to bring the cost down. So that made sense. So then I kind of put two and two together. I said, okay, whenever Bharti launches, I guess Mr. Narayan Murthy will have lower costs and the GE business will be much more profitable. So if I recall, at that point in time, the focus of Infosys and other software companies was not necessarily these massive campuses servicing the offshore model. It really was about computerizing India. The banks will computerize, State Bank of India will computerize. I remember in the 1990s, when calculators were being introduced to State Bank of India, the unions went on strike. Because a calculator would make someone lose a job, right? So, you know, that was the opportunity, right? You had people punching things with Excel sheets. I mean, why go far? In the 1980s, I was using broad sheets of paper lined and then folded like 20 times to make your own columns with just the folding without drawing a pencil and doing parta for the Birla Group. Right? That was the 1980s. Of course, I did get a BA analyst to calculator with me from the US. And not only that, of Hewlett-Packard, not only that, of Texas Instruments. Not only that, when the calculator got spoiled, I called them up and they were nice enough to send me back by ship, which took 3 months to come. Wow. But you know, but that was the era of the 80s, and then you know the 91 was globalization. So you still had very archaic systems in India, which need to be modernized. And I would, you know, I would hazard a guess, and I would say that much of the, if you look at the prospectus, I've not looked at it recently, but if my memory serves you right, it was focusing on the India opportunity, and kind of international was a sideshow, right? So, because it didn't make sense, you know, you have to padlock that one computer you have. You have to pay 1 lakh rupees a month. The security cost of looking after that one computer with a guard with a rifle maybe and stuff like that was probably not worth their margins. So, you know, that's the Infosys story. So we kind of liked that I spoke to, you know, the main fund manager in Hong Kong. And he said, yeah, sounds like a great story. Let's buy it. Let's subscribe. So we subscribed. And I think that was the last day of the IPO when we subscribed. And, you know, we were told that the NRI portion and the foreign portion and the non-resident Indian portion was undersubscribed. You know, great, you know, we'll just buy a chunk or subscribe for a chunk and see what happens. Now, you know, that was no value style of that. It was just like, that was just, you know, that was the Jardine Fleming shoot from the hip kind of, you know, whatever moves, run with it, whatever falls, jump out of it, kind of momentum investing if you no discipline around it. So, you know, we subscribe. And then a day later, you know, I get a call from Mr. Murthy and I get a call from Inam, which says that actually the IPO was oversubscribed. And if you wanted to buy 100, you know, basically you're not going to get 100, you're going to get 10, 20, 30, you know, whatever it is. And to fill the rest of the order, you got to buy it when it lists. So I actually remember calling up Mr. Murthy and having a, you know, talk with him. And he said, I'm sorry, you know, Enam has told me that it's oversubscribed. Nothing I can do. He's the client. Enam is a banker. And, you know, and of course, we had to buy it at 60, 70% higher share price from whoever sold it to us. So, you know, that again made me realize that is there a trick in the system? So it showed you the nascentness of everything we were doing, right? And thanks to SEBI, thanks to regulations since then, things have become much more transparent in the mechanism. The IPOs may still collapse, as we've seen from many IPOs recently. SEBI is not responsible for the pricing of the IPO. That's the investment banker's job. SEBI's role and the system's role is to ensure that money moves quickly and allocations are made fairly. That's what their role is. And I think people confuse that. You know, so this some meeting, kind of fast-forwarding very quickly to Paytm's and other stuff of the world. You can't blame SEBI for that.
Yeah.
I mean, SEBI just says you've got to tick the boxes, you do this, and you're fine. The valuation is the banker. The valuation is the banker under what the company accepts. And many times, the bankers drive the company. So I'm sure that Narayan Murthy in 1992 and Nandan Nilekani in 1992-93 had no clue what was oversubscription and how the process works. But in the process, we certainly, you know, I certainly believe that that we were gamed in some sense. The system was not transparent and we had to end up paying more shares. I mean, we did very well out of it. Anyone who held on to Infosys shares did very well out of it. So no grumbles. But so this meeting, how early India was.
This meeting with Mr. Murthy happened in 1993.
92, 93, when the IPO of Infosys was. Must have been 93 because...
Yeah, 92 markets had collapsed, the Harshal Mehta's...
No, that was... Yeah, that you're right. So it was probably after June, July 1993 because we had done the Hindalco GDR placement.
Okay.
And that was actually a turning point of the markets after the disastrous Reliance GDR placement of April, May 92.
Then you had the run till 94, the big run.
And then we had the run till December 94. Yeah. And I gave you a snippet of the Birla IPO of Birla TV, of the Business India TV story.
That's right. So what did you take away from the meeting? So apart from the IPO side, what did you take away from the meeting with Mr. Murthy? Did anything strike you?
I'm no one to judge. I mean, I was all of 32 years old. I didn't have a valuation principle metric in mind.
Yeah.
You know, but obviously fabulous, you know, came across as fantastic people, smart, knew what they wanted to do. I mean, clearly no one would have anticipated the kind of success that they've had. Mm-hmm. And I think to me, the turning points when I look at Infosys as a company was in 96, 97. And 99, 2000. Those to me are the big turning points. And I'll tell you why. Because in 96, 97, I forget the year exactly again, that's the beauty of getting old. You have a right to forget. You had a situation where they opened the second campus, a second large campus. I think there were 3,500 people then or something. And they were trying to open up a second campus. And we said, you know, I mean, how do you take that culture? How do you take all of that to a second location? You know, hats off to them. They did it. 99-2000. The way I see Indian tech is that when the internet bubble collapsed in the Western world and in India too, you had a lot of people unemployed in the IT sector, and they had H-1 visas and they'd gone to the US for Y2K, for that punching that whatever XX for the year became XXXXX, became 4Xs, right? So and they got paid a lot of money for that. That was basically body shopping. So there already was an entry into companies, but at the lowest level of just making XX into XXX and paying them, whatever, $20 per human manpower or whatever in India, or $15 per manpower then. And then you had the big knowledge gain when, because of the tech bubble, a lot of NRIs or Indians working in H1 with H1 visas, unemployed, come back to India and think of all the systems. Think of all the processes and experience they bring with them, the exposure. The same thing after 2003-04, after 9/11. Every time when you had SARS in March 2003, every time there's a collapse in the Western world, some Indian is getting nudged back. Not the people waving flags at Houston, Houston rallies, but the really knowledgeable pool of capital, professional capital, is moving back. And that's kind of, to me, that's India's phenomenal advantage compared to many, many other nations. Yeah. That people are willing to come back. Yeah. They're hungry to come back. Mm-hmm. They bring with them huge knowledge of systems, which allows the scaling to happen. Right. And why was 1997 off? Because if in the Indian context of power cuts and lack of infrastructure, if you can build a second oasis, the Infosys campus was the first one. You could build a second oasis. You can operate in Mars. You can operate anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Right. And then it's like, then there's no stopping you. Mm-hmm. So then it's like leapfrog after that. Then you hit the hockey stick, like you've gone up the J curve.
So I'll just add my Infosys story to this. Mm-hmm. So, so of course, I was working at Equity Master all those years, except for a small gap when I went to study. So came back, the tech boom was on. We started covering, you remember, you know, when I came back to office, you had a sheet of paper waiting for me. You were, of course, traveling, which introduced me to the concept of user news, right? So we pulled up our sleeves and went headlong. So we started building the research team and all, you know, the story is well known. Somewhere in, was it 21 or 20, 2001 or 2002? So there had been a long trend of Infosys meeting their quarterly numbers.
And it was March 2003.
March 2003, there you go. So there was a long trend of Infosys meeting their numbers. And that was the, everyone was focused on that number for weeks in advance and weeks later. So March 23, Infosys disappointed. The first time in a, they missed their quarterly numbers. So someone in my team wrote a pretty sensational headline. And he wrote, "History created, Infosys disappoints." Right? And we wrote a piece saying that this is what happens. And morning India time, I think Ajit was that time, you were in the US those days, night your time. And unexpectedly, you sent us a piece to publish. And the title of that piece, if you remember, was "History Repeats, Analysts Fail." Because all that the analysts were doing, they were just expecting Infosys to keep going quarter on quarter without sort of factoring in any bump. So that was a very interesting episode that we went through.
I hope I got the timeline right. You may be early. It may have happened 2001. Because 2003 was really about forward guidance. I don't think they, because SARS had happened in March 2003. And I think they just came, Nandan Nilkani got up and he said, "We are unclear what's going to happen for the rest of the year," because the whole world was unclear.
Yeah, that was, I remember
the first pandemic that we were living through. Mm-hmm. We've just gone through COVID now. Yeah. I was the first one that was living through it. You know, so that may have been an earlier quarter.
But that was an amazing experience. It stuck in all our memories, everyone in the team. Yeah. Big lesson learned. So you spoke about, shoot from the hip, momentum, et cetera, et cetera, in buying Infosys, no fancy valuation model.
Yeah.
A jump a few years. Mm-hmm. And when you were in the US at Hansberger Global, I think something landed on your desk. And that was a note from, I think, Thomas Hansberger. Not a note. It was on Enron. Enron as a potential investment opportunity. So tell us about the story. I think that's very instructive. And, I would love for you to share it with us.
Yeah, sure. So, I met Tom Hansberger in July of 1997. And I had broken off my joint venture with Jardine. And I was managing the venture capital pool of money with Walden. And then the other India fund with Prolific out of London. And at that point in time, we were looking for a third client in the US. I met Tom and Tom said, "You come and live here and forget the other clients and be dedicated to us." So after speaking to Sabu and Shankar at that time, that's what we ended up doing. Actually, Shankar was not there yet, but he was joining at that point in time. And as a value manager, Tom wanted me to look at utilities, Asian utilities first. So Korea Electric, Tokyo Electric, the Indian Electric Company, BSES and all. And then to kind of understand what's happening in the world. So I was covering global utilities. So all the energy companies in the world, not the oil companies, but the electricity companies. And so I always like to ask the company a simple question. And the question is, what do you do? Right? I mean, I kind of know what the company is doing, but I want to hear it from the company. What do you do? And this was at a conference in Miami. And the head of Enron's Latin American business, very glibly, he said, "We are short power." So I kind of like, that's not the answer I expected. So I said, "What do you mean you're short power?" He said, "Well, so in contrast to, say, Tata Power, which owns a plant, generates electricity, and now has to find a buyer." Mm-hmm. So they are long power. They have power with them. They're short of customers. They're short customer. Mm-hmm. And they're long power. Mm-hmm. So in Enron's case, he said, "We're short power." So what he was trying to say was, we don't own the power plant. Mm-hmm. We are the distribution guys who own the customer network. And we'll always have more customers than we'll have power.
Correct.
So if Rahul puts on two more air conditioners, we have to supply that power. Right. Now, if you invest in the factory, then stock markets don't like that. It takes 3 years to build a power plant. And so your valuation doesn't come, you know, it's going to be grounded because you've got CapEx going on, interest going on. It's sexier to just buy the power from someone else, right? Through an exchange that you help create or promote or whatever it is. So Enron was also featured in The Economist. So I wrote a report for our internal team in Hansberger's office saying that, you know, we should not be buying this company because it was trading at 35 or 40 times PE ratio, something stupid. And if it's a trading company, because I asked this head of Latin America, I said, when you're short something, you have to know when to cover it, right? When to buy it back, because Rahul will only pay X rupees per unit of power. If the price is low, do I buy it then? Do I wait for it to go lower? I have to be a trading. So the guy told me, he said, we have a black box. We have a black box that tells us when to buy and sell. So I'm thinking, okay, this guy's a trader. He's buying and selling power, right? And he may make a wrong judgment. Then he loses money. He makes a right judgment. He makes money. He's basically rolling the dice. He's going to Mahalakshmi race course and backing a horse. Right? The horse may win. The horse may not win. So why do I want to give him a PE of 50? When earnings are uncertain, and we'd already begun to learn the value systems by then, the valuation systems by then through Tom Hansberger, you don't pay a lot of PE for uncertain earnings. You pay a higher PE for more certain earnings, right? Just buy a stock like Hindustan Lever or PNG in India because there's certainty of consumption patterns as opposed to Tata Steel. One day steel price goes up, next day steel price goes down sort of thing, right? So you don't. So we said, okay, fine. If you want to buy the stock, you pay 8 times PE ratio, not 35 or 40 times, which means the stock has to fall a lot. So obviously, we're not buying it. And of course, between the time I wrote my report and the time that Tom Hansberger left a note for me, because The Economist magazine had written an article in The Economist about how wonderful a company Enron was, and they were the future. You should try to dig that up. That was the tech bubble of 2000, which exploded. So between 1999, September, and Feb 2000, that's when the article was written. So Tom basically, you know, I'd gone on an overseas trip for research or whatever. So he basically had left a note on my sheet with The Economist saying, read this sort of thing, like, you know, you idiot, you know. Like, so, of course, when I came back, I saw that thing and I read the article. I'd probably read it already on a plane or something, but I read it and, you know, went back to him and said, you know, I don't like it still. It's still what it is. But, you know, that's what happens. I mean, it's you get tested. We have seen over the last decade, as a value investor, the principles of valuations and the principles of values. Values means goodness, and valuation is numbers. And I want to separate the two. So I really believe that Warren Buffett is obviously, we all know and fully agree with, a fantastic value investor. He understands valuations and business. But I'm not so sure whether he's a values investor. I stopped following Warren Buffett in terms of, you know, glorifying the stuff. I mean, of course, you follow him and track him. Ever since he did the Goldman Sachs deal after this Lehman, you know, collapse. Because in all his annual reports prior to that, he was telling us about these weapons of mass destruction, the, you know, sort of their derivatives and everything goes with it, with the housing bubble. And Goldman Sachs is one of the biggest players in the market. And then you buy them because they're giving you a 9% coupon and a great deal. You know, kind of, I would have used my power to kick out the Goldman team rather than to support them with a 9% coupon return to me. So, you know, you can make a great rate of return. And that's one reason why, you know, we've been controversial in some sense. And I'm going to leapfrog a bit to Elon Musk. And what just happened. So, you know, we're now sitting on the 19th of May, and on the 18th of May, Elon Musk put out a tweet because the S&P 500 removed Tesla from the index. So if you're a pension fund doing any kind of passive investing, a retail limit passive investing, you no longer own Tesla because S&P 500 has taken Tesla out as per the tweet. I've not read the actual press release, but as per what happened in the last day, that's what it seems. And, you know, if that's true, that's, and obviously it's because, you know, Elon Musk is who he is. You may like him, you may not like him. You may have views on him. Some people find him to be an idiot. Some are genius. Some worship him. Some find he's a blasphemist, or, you know, whatever, because of his purchase of Twitter, proposed acquisition of Twitter. And, you know, and he's out there saying, I'll put Donald Trump back on. I'll put whoever back on. And he also put out a tweet yesterday saying, I'm no longer a Democrat. I'm now going to vote Republican. So,
yeah.
Because this is all sort of, you know, politics. Now, S&P 500, the rating company, the same rating entities that were called before the Congress in the U.S. and could not quite explain how they were complicit in the entire housing collapse and the global financial crisis that have put hundreds of millions of people around the world out of jobs and into economic distress. And I had read a research by someone from Oxford that I think 500,000 or a million people actually got cancer and died because of that. If they can put such correlation, I don't know. But it certainly must have caused a bunch of distress, suicides, depression, whatever else, right? And so those rating agencies have taken it upon their wisdom to brand Elon Musk as a failure of ESG, right? Maybe because he's smoking pot while he interviewed with someone, I think four or five years ago.
Joe Rogan.
I forget the year, but of 2018, whatever the year was, 2016. You know, I don't know what the reasons are.
Yeah.
But, and in the Indian context, if I transfer this to India, so because I don't know much about the rest of the world, but I can certainly talk about India, there are companies that we would never, ever, ever own for our clients, which are in the index. So the quantum index funds owns it because we have to follow the index. But as a value manager with a values discipline around us, we're not buying Reliance, we're not buying Sterlite, we're not buying SR, we're not buying, you know, Vedanta now, Jindal, et cetera, et cetera. These are all powerhouses of the Indian business landscape. They're powerhouses of the stock market indices, right? Nothing to take away from their business success. Please don't mix the two, right? So Warren Buffett would buy them because he would look at the business success. The values principles that we've imbibed from Tom do not allow us, in some sense, to invest in companies unless boards are more independent. You know, the whole structure and style of decision-making, for good or for bad, right? Reliance as a stock and other companies too as stocks have done fantastically well. So, you know, our investors can put a gun to our head and pull the trigger and shoot us and say, hey, you idiot, you made us miss out on, you know, great returns. That's not us. You should not come to us if returns is all you want. Because at one extreme, if returns are all you want, please, you know, get in touch with the Matka King, get in touch with, you know, with the guys who are doing sort of cocaine smuggling and gold smuggling, and they'll give you all the returns you want at one extreme. Right, to take it to the other end. And it's not that every call that we make on values is correct. It's not that every call that we make on valuation is correct. But it's kind of insulting from an Indian perspective to read that Tesla is kicked out of the S&P 500 and other larger established industrial houses dominate big time the Indian S&P BSE 30 index, because BSE 30 now has a tie-up with S&P. Yeah. And, you know, and there are S&P indices in the international market. So pensions and other global investors who are naively mirroring the S&P indices for India are looking at, okay, we got a low-cost product. But you know what? You're supporting and effectively partnering managements with questionable practices, or put it this way, with not the best practices that are there as per the listing requirements or as per the SEBI sort of suggestions on what governance should be, right? About having independent chairman, independent board members, all of that stuff. So again, it's not to take away the successful businesses built by enterprises, right? But it is to question, because our processes taught to us by Tom Hansberg were to look at both, right? And of course, that values is now called ESG. It's now been refined and defined over the last decade, but we started this in 1996. Right. So we've started this just at the time when we met Tom, actually a little before that, when we met Tom, and then Tom taught us a lot more about it. Intuitively, we felt, and this came from someone who met me in 1989, a few months before I was starting Quantum. He said, young man, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to set up an investment firm focused on India. And he told me, he says, well, I have one bit of advice for you. When you shake someone's hands and you get your hand back, see if you have five fingers left. If you don't have five fingers, never shake the hands again. And we made an investment in Jardine Fleming Quantum in Reliance in October we were big investors, and October 1994, they did something which to me was bad act. And ever since then, I've been very nervous and wary of groups of that nature. And that came to the fore. What that gentleman from South Africa told me, I can't remember his name, sadly. He said, you know, count your fingers when you get them back. And, you know, we didn't have, at least I didn't have five fingers left when I made that investment in terms of trust.
Yeah. So I'm thinking the valuation and the values thing. So you're putting more constraints on yourself.
Yes.
But it also is in sync with, I've heard you say over 25 years, is the means to an end is as important as the end.
Absolutely. So, that's, you know, that's Mahatma Gandhi saying, right?
So what's the point in getting the highest return if you've gone through all kinds of roads? You know, you want to follow a good path and get a good return.
There's nothing wrong with focusing on returns. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
But then don't come to quantum value fund for that, right?
Yeah.
You can invest the quantum equity fund of funds, which is looking at other fund managers, other styles, and there's no focus on values in that. It's whichever other style. So we do own Reliance, but quantum long-term money hasn't signed the check you know, to buy Reliance stock or buy stock. I don't want to put out one company, but in general, any of those companies. But the other fund managers we've invested in that basket of mutual funds, which gives investors 200, 250 underlying shares, there is definitely Reliance in that. So we have a style of investing in quantum mutual fund. There is a style of investing which other fund managers have, which include the Reliance and the Vedanta and the others in it. And the stocks are there. And then you've got the Nifty index of, you know, quantum Nifty, which is what the S&P 500 is. So we leave the choice to the investor. And it's not that we want to force everyone to give up returns. We say, look, maybe you sprinkle the money a bit. That's what I do, right? Yep. You sprinkle the money a bit. Mm-hmm. So it's not that I don't own Reliance, but we haven't signed a check for Reliance. We have got the Nifty fund, which has Reliance in it. I personally own some of the quantum equity fund of funds. I'm sure there's some Reliance, but I've never really checked the underlying number of stocks recently. But I know when we built the fund years ago, I think a decade ago, we knew there was Reliance in it. So that's a different style. We're not criticizing any style.
Yeah.
But we criticize an act. If S&P tells me Tesla is out of the index, but Exxon can remain, and Exxon is emitting huge amounts of carbon, and coal companies can remain, and you know, Goldman Sachs can remain, and JP Morgan can remain, and Citibank can remain. I mean, I don't know if you see the documentaries on these firms. You know, you should please watch. You must see The Inside Job, one of the best documentaries ever made
about
the financial crisis. It is absolutely fantastic. I actually reached out to the producer. They never wrote to me. I said, look, please, can I don't have a lot of money, but I can pay you a few hundred rupees to buy the rights to air this film across the country for free. Give everyone popcorn to watch it, you know. You will never trust a financial firm after you watch that.
And if you want to see a little more mainstream version, you can see The Big Short.
Yeah, but The Big Short is more like a you know, it's got a Hollywood approach.
Yeah,
to it.
Yeah, of course.
This is factual documentary interviews, including interviews with professors at very famous business schools, for which some of your viewers are sending their kids abroad and paying $60,000 a year as tuition for them to learn MBA, you know, to learn, get the MBA degree. Mm-hmm. And those professors are found to be completely fraudulent individuals who have sacrificed and rewritten what they've said to please the audience of their backers. So the whole system is kind of in substance corrupted, but you know, another session on that. But I really believe that, you know, this whole movement of ESG, again, no one knows, we're all floundering in the dark. But hopefully, if that means that's the first step, then we can expect some changes in India or in the Asian indices, right? I mean, for example, China has, I think, occupies a third of the weight of emerging market indices. So if you're worried about governance, you probably should be throwing out China.
You know,
a lot of the Chinese companies, right, from the indices. So there's a lot of, you know, work to be done on that. And again, we don't believe we are the only people holding a flag and waving it. We believe we're all trying to learn and figure out the right path. But if something you know is not good, then you should avoid doing it on behalf of investors.
So something I never figured out in all these decades is, how do these credit rating agencies get away with it? It is so big. In India, we've had this case, right? When the mutual fund case happened and all those other cases, you know, they should have rated the paper correctly, right? And they all get away scot-free, yeah?
Yeah. So, you know, they go behind the veil, as do the IT companies under Section 230, I think it is of some act in the US. Mm-hmm. They go behind the veil that we are not managing your portfolio. It's like we're showing you this stuff, we're giving it AAA, but please don't hold us accountable for it.
My God.
So but it's AAA, but don't hold us accountable if it's not AAA. So, you know, why are you paying these guys for their AAA? Why do you use them at all? Right. And it's a bit, I mean, if you take your business as Equity Master, take our business as running a quantum mutual funds business of running a mutual fund, you know, we're making calls with the best information available then. Mm-hmm. So Equity Master may make a call and you may make a client buy a stock and the stock price may fall over the next 3 years. Mm-hmm. So should someone sue you, right? Mm-hmm. A quantum mutual fund is taking client money and buying stock ABC. We bought Yes Bank after Rana Kapoor was kicked out. And in the first 4 or 5 months, the stock went up by 35%. And then literally a few months later, you were down 80% of your purchase price. So, you know, should we get sued for that? No. You make an informed decision.
Yeah.
The question is to the rating agencies is, who paid you the money for the rating? That's where the problem
comes. The incentives are not aligned properly.
Yeah. If Yes Bank had paid Quantum Mutual Fund money to buy the stock,
that's right, fraud.
Then that's bad. That's what's happening with the rating agency. So it's not the call or the bad judgment. It can happen to anyone, any professional, a doctor, a lawyer, or investment professional. It's who's paying you for the advice.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, so if you wrote a report saying buy stock XYZ and your subscribers believed you and XYZ company had paid you money or paid some incentive, that's where the illegality comes in.
That's right.
But, you know, but in the rating business, it's open book because everyone knows that the companies are paying the rating agencies for the rating.
Yeah.
And people are buying it.
I think this is my, you know, big conspiracy theory on this podcast. I think a lot of these rating agencies are also rating governments.
Yeah.
And this is really state policy, right? They're controlling global policy and using ratings as a lever. And the payback is go into anything you want as long as you...
Yes and no. So, you know, the same S&P index provider, S&P rated the US as you know, no longer best quality credit in 2018 or something, to be fair.
Okay.
So, you know, they did go against their own sovereign.
Yeah.
I don't think it was in reaction to all the questioning happening to them in the Senate or the House of, you know, in the House of Republicans, in the House or whatever. But, you know, but they did. I mean, they have gone against. But I don't, again, rating, who pays the money, there should be a very clear disclosure. And that's what I don't like. In the case of taking Tesla out and keeping other companies in, there's something political around it, unless we see over the next few months some big names. I mean, imagine tomorrow S&P announces that Reliance is out of the index.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have built an ESG index in India. And in the last 3 years, Reliance has been in and out of that index. They've taken from like a 15 or 12 or 20% weighting down to zero. And then again, it's come back.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in the course of 6 months? That in two quarters, you bring it in, you take it out and bring it back in. That sort of stuff gets to be a bit, you know, sort of makes you feel uncomfortable about that. But like I said, we're all learning. It's not that Quantum has the best ESG research process.
Mm-hmm.
We'll probably be making mistakes and blunders as we go along too. But there should be no ill will. There should be no bad intent behind what you're doing as you learn. That's the key thing.
So, you know, we spoke a little bit about Buffett. So this is a question I ask everyone. If you were to bump into Buffett, what's the one question that you would ask him?
Look, he's an absolute genius, right?
Mm-hmm.
Total genius. So there's not. So it would be, you know, you wrote all these things about, you know,
investment banks,
about their instruments, and then you go and invest in them. You know, and then Wells Fargo and other banks. I mean, now rumor that he's bought Citibank. I mean, you know, if you see all the documentaries out there about the laundering, about the misplacement of client trust and all that. You know, these are they. And but you know, at the same time, Charlie Munger said he likes the Chinese government.
Yeah,
you know, you saw that statement. So again, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with saying these are my credentials and I work within this space. Mm-hmm. And in that space, I'm a genius and I dominate it. There's huge respect for that. Don't ever take that away from what's achieved, you know, but it's something to me. There's no question of that's what they are. But, you know, clearly, he's made some phenomenal genius calls where he said, I don't necessarily have to go to emerging markets because the companies I buy are investing around the world.
Yep.
And, you know, it becomes easier from a governance standpoint, theoretically, to just invest in US-based multinationals who have to comply with a lot of laws and as they invest in emerging markets and all. So, yeah. So, you know, it would be really about, you know, will you ever move from value investing to values investing?
Yeah, that's a good question to ask him. Closer home, let's say you bump into Nirmala Sitharaman. Only one question you got. Like, what would you ask her?
Many questions. But I think the one would be that, you know, I think I'll just, before I come to the question.
Sure.
I think she's evolved in her job in some sense, right? Mm-hmm. You throw someone to be finance minister from being commerce minister, whatever. You evolving into a job. And I think she's actually done a pretty remarkable job of handling things over the last, particularly the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. So initially the COVID response was very weak. Mm-hmm. And then you saw the government taking note.
Yep.
And the messaging came from her very clear on that. So I'm actually, you know, I wouldn't rate her as one of India's best prime ministers doing some massive reform, but she's going on a path which is putting India in the right direction.
Yeah.
My only question would be, you know, do you think you can disconnect the phone to LIC and RBI?
Yeah.
Right? From the Ministry of Finance. You know, there's a meme going around now, right, in the WhatsApp chat groups that, you know, we feel sorry for LIC. They always supported other people's stocks by buying the market. And now no one is supporting their stock, you know. You know, and this is not something to do with the BJP or it's been there for decades.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There was UTI, which then went bankrupt, went into trouble under the chairman, Manohar Ferwani, who brought a lot of disrepute effectively. And, you know, he's hastened the shutting down of the old UTI as we know it. And then you have the case, you know, of LIC for decades, you know, which has had, you know, supported friends and family and been pressured to do things. So I think India's on a fabulous flight path. I'm very optimistic on India. I think the government is doing a lot of good things, largely allowing the reforms that were set up in 1991 and then the next generation that happened later. And, you know, things from the Vajpayee government, from the Manmohan Singh government, they're picking up the good pieces and they're carrying on with it. The fear factor when the BJP first came to power, the Prime Minister Modi, was they were questioning Aadhaar, and as Nandan Nilekani said very recently on a video that's going around, that Prime Minister Modi met him for half an hour and understood Aadhaar and you know kept it. So full credit, right? Narega, the same thing. You know, they want to kick out Narega or stop Narega or slow Narega, and Narega is extremely important to keep the poor people in India on a path of some hope and some way to climb up an economic ladder. So, you know, hats off to the government for doing those things. Hats off to the government for pursuing with the path. So I did not like demonetization. It was a disaster. I strongly believed that there was a political agenda behind it. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of, you know, back in the past in history. But hats off to the government for promoting and pushing forward the sort of digitalization of Indian, you know, I don't know whether people know this, but Quantum Mutual Fund was taken up as a pilot in 2013, 2014 for seeing whether mutual funds can be part of an Aadhaar, KYC and a transaction engine. So because, you know, when we started in 2006, we were the only fund house that offered only online transactions, right? Mm-hmm. There was no distributor who sold a form. You could come to our own sales team, and you could then buy our products online. So because we had adopted as much as Equity Master in 1996, April 22nd, 1996, Equity Master was effectively the first financial portal. It was called quantumindia.com, but you were the first financial portal at that point in time. So we have a lot of first to our credit.
Yep.
But we're not first in market cap, but hopefully first in what we do is make the right thing for our clients and our customers.
Yes. One thing, Nirmala Sitharaman, I agree with everything you said, and I try and study this closely, but one thing I would add to that is I'm very happy she reduced the length of her budget speeches.
Yeah.
I think it was high time she did that, and she did that. It's quick learner.
No, yeah. You know, I want to emphasize, I think you have to give credit where credit is due.
I completely agree.
I think that the BJP is getting it, is understanding it. They still have stuff that they're doing, which I personally don't like and other people don't like. But I think on policy making, they're getting a lot of things, you know, for the overall movement of India in the right direction. They're getting it and they're doing it. So you have to give credit where credit is due.
Sure. Okay. And I'm going to ask you a few questions on the critical days and where you were and what you did, right? Tell me personally, tell me professionally, investing wise. First was 9/11. The 9/11 attacks in the US.
Yeah. So 9/11. So I want, you know, I was literally traveling. It just struck me, and I just go before I answer your question. There are two different dates of 9/11. So 9/11 in the US context is September 11th.
Yes.
Right? The month comes first.
Yeah.
The date comes second. There's another extremely important 9/11. And I really want to write an honest truth and restart writing with this.
Please do. It
just struck me while I was thinking about this. And I was reading something and it just triggered this thought. The other 9/11 is the fall of the Berlin Wall, 9th November.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there are two 9/11s. Oh. That was 1989.
Yeah.
The other was, but no one talks about the year. You just say 9/11.
Oh, wow.
So there are two very important dates you should ask me a question of. I'll talk about the Berlin Wall first.
Yes.
The 9/11. I think I mentioned this in part one. The 9th of November, when the Berlin Wall fell, I was with Mr. Birla in his outhouse in Birla Mansion in Birla House in Bombay.
Yeah.
And it was late in the night, evening, and the first cracks of the wall were appearing, if you will. And you know, he was reading the Financial Times and, you know, with his things like this, his glasses down and everything else. And the BBC radio was on and we heard about the Berlin Wall falling and under threat of falling that night. And he said, Ajit, I mentioned this in the previous, in the first episode, this is India's moment.
Yeah.
And so I was with him at that momentous day when India, like Mr. Sitharaman will hopefully do, cut off the phone connection to LIC and to RBI. We cut off the phone connection to Russia, effectively, right? Because Russia was bust.
Yeah.
And if you dial the number, there was no one there to answer the phone at the other end. So that was a dead phone. The other nine, so that was a birth of India, in some sense, the creation of the modern capitalist, pro-business, pro-market economy India. And then the other 9/11, which has also impacted India and the world in much of it, and also has been this of 9/11 when when Saudi citizens and other citizens went, you know, took planes and, knocked off, firstly had an assault on US soil, the first time since Pearl Harbor. And both are significant dates in history because 9/11 of the Berlin Wall has ushered in a massive movement towards freedom, democracy, and with that, capitalism to a large extent, with China being an outlier, where they have state-controlled capitalism by and large, as has been proven again with their recent actions over the last year. And on the other side, 9/11, was a setback, right? At that 9/11, I was working with Tom Hansberger. I was in my room in the Florida office of Hansberger Global Investors. And it was morning, of course, doing research or whatever. And then my colleague, Brian, Hansberger then came in and said, Ajit, knocked on the door, Ajit, come quickly. So as a value investor, we had no television screens in our rooms. The only television screen was in the trading room with the traders.
Mm-hmm.
We had no Bloomberg screen on our table. There was no noise.
Wow.
You know, Warren Buffett sits in Omaha.
Mm-hmm.
And he has very little noise, but a lot of information and a lot of knowledge. So that was Tom Hansberger's way of showing us to avoid the noise. So we all rushed, and I rushed with my colleagues there to the trading room. At that time, I was the deputy chief investment officer of Hansberger Global Investors and kind of de facto CIO and CEO heir apparent of the enterprise. Tom wanted me to live and work in Florida. And we went to the room, and everyone, you know, the traders were ashen-faced, and markets, of course, were falling for what it's worth, but the screens were there.
Mm-hmm.
And just at that moment, the second plane.
Mm-hmm.
So must have been like not even a gap of 3 minutes or four. It was very quick. Mm-hmm. First plane hit, went in quickly. And then the TV screen actually saw the second plane flying in, like, I don't know, a few minutes later. It all happened very quickly. Now, I don't know if it was a replay, but I think I saw it live, the second plane coming in. So I was there in Florida. A very disturbing time for everyone, because obviously that led to, you know, the invasion of Iraq by the U.S. Mm-hmm. As much as Russia has invaded Ukraine,
mm-hmm.
The U.S. invaded Iraq, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, the U.S., you know, got its sort of, you know, allies together and had to show that it wanted to act and, you know, as we know, created a mess in the Middle East mm-hmm. in that sense. So yeah, so both were very different turning points. One very positive when the Berlin Wall fell, 9th November 9/11, and one extremely negative when you had, you know, and it's funny because when I was flying, when I was on a plane, I was flying from London, I saw this 6-year-old kid with his parents, and they were putting the, you know, they checked the thing, any kind of thing like
that.
Like a 6-year-old kid has to be scanned, you know, because something went beep, you know, like really, I mean, what a world.
So at Hansberger, when you saw that unfortunate events transpire, what did you guys do with money? So the markets were closed for a few days, then they opened.
The markets were closed for a few days,
yeah,
you know, for a week or so. The exchange was closed, New York was closed. But you know, I mean, obviously there was value. We were buying. We became buyers of stocks, right? There was value at that time, not the, you know.
Okay. So the next date I have for you is 24th July 91, Manmohan Singh's first budget.
24th July 1991.
I don't know whether that date is more important or the date when he announced the devaluation.
Yeah, I would say period. So, that you're talking about now 10 years before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on a plane. So budget, I was in India.
Mm-hmm.
Budget, he gave a speech. He gave an interview to mm-hmm. Economic Times, which I think I've kept somewhere in the files of Quantum in some warehouse.
Okay.
Economic Times, of course, has it. 2-page interview. And he makes a very, very important point then, mm-hmm. which comes to the South African gentleman shaking my hands in 1989 and advice. He made this phrase, he said, investment is an act of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Investment is an act of faith. 6 words, right? Extremely important. And that goes back to shaking hands and fingers and all that mm-hmm. stuff and mm-hmm. seeing how many fingers you get back. And what Dr. Manmohan Singh, and so that whole interview was about, you know, India reforming and the need for reform.
Yeah.
And I think he was asked about, you know, what's next for India? Like, how will people react? And that was the investment in act of faith. And every time a fund manager makes an investment in a company,
mm-hmm.
every time a subscriber of Equity Master is subscribing to your product and buying a share based on your subscription recommendations, that investment is an act of faith. Because no matter what the business plan says, no matter what the numbers say,
mm-hmm.
you are expecting the people you're investing in to deliver on a promise. And that's an act of faith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and of course, I can tell you an instance in my life where I have let my investors down. who've invested in quantum companies, and the act of faith is sort of diluted. But that's what you're really doing. You're giving a check, and you're not going to see the money again unless the person you invest with, which is also what leads to the values part of investing.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. If I can model a company's business outlook, I can try to figure out in the next 20, 30 years, what will be the population of India? How many people will have cell phones? How many people are going to a Kirana store to buy food? Who's going to brush their teeth? You can kind of make estimates of that. How do you model government policy and connectivity with governments in an Excel sheet? How do you know who the next, you know, crony capitalist or influential capitalist is going to be? Right? You have no clue. There are so many people who are today large, who were kind of non-existent before Prime Minister Modi became Prime Minister in 2014. There are so many companies who are large today who were non-existent, you know, before 1977 when FERA laws changed and, you know, there was a surge of IPOs. So there were many companies who were large then and are nowhere today, Sahara, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it works always. And if you can't model connectivity, if connectivity is all that keeps a business person as an advantage, how do I know the genetic is that the genetic success is going to be guaranteed for me in an organization's DNA? And where I'm a long-term investor. I'm not here for satta. I don't understand trading. I don't understand I mean, I've tried it and lost money each time. But you know, I don't understand anything to do where the time horizon is less than 5, 7, 10 years. If the time horizon is 1 day, 1 minute, I have no clue what's happening, you know. But yeah, to me, that's the thing, that I can't model connectivity.
Yeah.
And if I can't model connectivity, there's no way I'm going to invest in that stock as an individual.
And the last date I have is the Lehman blowout. That was September 15th, 2008.
Yeah. But I just want to finish this, the story of Manmohan Singh. So I was in Bombay. You may have your dates wrong, right? But you have your dates right. But the few weeks before that, July 1 and I think July 3 was a devaluation. Two successful devaluations.
Okay, it was before. It was before the budget.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Two successful devaluations before the budget, and I was on my way with a quantum PowerPoint to meet the chairman of Barclays Worldwide in UK. Right. And I was carrying a PowerPoint to talk about the beauty of India's future, how India was going to do well. And I'd written an article in the Wall Street Journal, as I said, in 1990, February about that. And I was, you know, believe that story big time, believe that thesis big time. And I was carrying PowerPoints to go and meet him and convince him to invest in, you know, in quantum and be a joint venture partner for quantum. And I remember I, you know, sort of plane landed at Heathrow Airport at 6:30 in the morning. I paid £5 to go and have a shower. So I have to shave for, you know, Lord Tom Camoy, it was at that point, and go and see him. And I walk into his office and he looks at me and he says, you must have heard that India just devalued the currency. Whoever wants to invest in India now, you know, that kind of thing. So I know where I was. I was on a journey trying to pitch India as a fabulous destination for investment and quantum as the partner, as a company to partner with, to get foreign capital, to get foreign inflows in, portfolio inflows in, and to build out something of India. So I remember that very, very clearly.
There must be some experience, huh? What about Lehman? Where were you on Lehman and what did you do after that?
So we left Hansberger and I was in India at that point in time in Bombay, kind of building out quantum as an independent standalone investment firm, no broking, no nothing, but just focused on. And we, of course, launched the first set of quantum mutual funds.
In 3 years in, I would say 3.5 years in, roughly.
March 2006. So just about 2.5 years. March 2006. March 13th, 2006 was the first NAV of the Quantum Long-Term Value Fund. And this happened on 15th of September. And of course, the markets collapsed. And you mentioned October, which is the right month. October was when the Indian rupee collapsed.
Okay.
Also, it took a little bit of a shock to come, but it collapsed from October. It collapsed. So the markets fell by, 55%, and the dollar rupee by 25% over that few months. And the index was bouncing between 8,000 and 10,000 from September 15th, 2008, right till the green shoots. No, not even beyond that, actually, because we had our elections in India in May of 2009. And that election was a surprise win what became UPA one. But anyway, so to get back to the story, that I was in India and I remember the opportunity to us was fantastic. Mm-hmm. We actually did a research report and we sent it out in a few days as quickly as we could. The thesis again to our international clients and wrote about it in India too and told everyone to buy shares. We had cash, about 15% cash at that time in the value fund in India, and started deploying and told people to start buying, and great time to buy and all that stuff. And but we prepared a report to show that on an actual reality basis, there was no harm or very little harm done to India's story because of Lehman. And I think the number was like 0.5% or less of GDP would be impacted. And if stock markets are reflecting GDP, which they should and would in the long run, all else being equal, if GDP is not impacted, why should the stock markets fall by 55% and the currency fall by 25%? So we sent out an extremely strong buy signal to clients at that point in time. So we were excited. We were like, literally, as you put the expression into our client notes, international client notes, that we were literally dancing on the table and jumping on the table. So give us more money, invest, invest, invest at that point in time.
That's a big call, right? And as history tells us, it was right. It was right big time. So,
well, like I told you, we made some other calls of not buying certain companies and their stock price has gone up.
So yeah, that's
credit both sides of calls to us. Yeah,
that's right. What keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up at night, personally or company-wise or markets-wise?
Oh, tell me all three. One by one. Yeah, if they are.
Sure. Markets-wise, the easy one. Nothing keeps me up at night. If I have a 12, 20, 80 portfolio, in my case, closer to a 36 months of emergency funds expenditure and a 20 gold and 80 in my basket of quantum long-term value fund is big, quantum equity fund of fund is big, and the Quantum India ESG fund. I don't own the Nifty fund. Those three equity exposures mark my 80 balance, 80% allocation. I have nothing to worry about. Nothing.
Okay.
Absolutely nothing. Second, work, quantum. So, quantum is, is an absolute dream. It's been an experiment. I've had the joy, privilege, honor working with you, working with Subbu, and so many other colleagues who joined along the way. Many left and haven't stayed for the journey. But, as you know, you and I and Subbu are still friendly with those who've left. And we all shared a lot of common, soulness, if you can call it that. So quantum is an experiment in many, many, many ways, right? It's an experiment on trying to do the right thing, experiment on having certain principles. There are four P's in our business, right? So you look at the people behind the firm, you look at the philosophy, look at the processes in place, and look at the performance, predictable performance that comes from the processes. So working and building on four P's with you, with Subbu, with others who've joined and are sort of building other asset classes, Arvind Chari on fixed income, Ashwin on real estate, Chirag has been an absolute smart person and genius, been helping us build the gold, the commodities, and then the ESG stuff. And then also and also Hiten, who did his work on long short products for us on quantum mutual fund side. So, everyone's contributed on the investment processes. Then, of course, the marketing teams and the compliance teams. We would certainly not have built the compliance teams we've got without Murali and the help we got from Russell Associates out of the US, who helped us, take our intent into fabulous, I wouldn't say manuals, but phenomenal guidance structures that we have across the quantum group. So that's all fantastic. And but we haven't quite succeeded in terms of market cap, right? I think if you want to have a thesis and then you experiment to see if that thesis is right. Mm-hmm. And then as a scientist or as someone involved in a thesis, as a sociologist, as anything, you say, oh, wow, that's right. And it worked out right. So quantum has worked out right for some people, hasn't worked out right for a large number of investors who still don't know about us, who still haven't experienced what quantum is about, still haven't. And again, it's not that everyone must believe in value and values, or everyone must believe in the transparency and the independence of your research, or the independence and transparency of personal defense research. Not necessary. But I'm sure there are many, many more people that we call the thoughtful investors who are missing from, you know, from the quantum stable of investors. So that's the sadness. That's the sadness that we haven't cracked it. We haven't gone up that hockey stick big time. And, you know, we've never purchased a customer, right? We never, in the we don't buy customers. You get them to subscribe. And what you do too, you share a view, you have ideas, you have thoughts, and people then like what you're saying. It resonates to them and they subscribe. Same thing with people then. So, you know, that's kind of a sadness that we haven't, you know, we're not there. So we're still, I wouldn't say we're a thesis. We're certainly successful, you know, we're making money, we're doing well, but, you know, we're not mainstream. We're not mainstream. Again, I don't mean mainstream in the sense that 100 out of 100 people have to buy us. Yeah. If there are five thoughtful investors in the country, those five should be buying us. And probably 0.01 of those five or 0.1 of those five are buying us today, or, you know, looking at our products and listening to us. That's the sadness. And then the next thing is in that is that, you know, because of the lack of success, I would love for you, Subbu, everyone to be financially extremely well off and comfortable. I'm not saying y'all are not, but you know, everyone's got an ESOP plan, and the true wealth comes, as we've seen from Infosys, the true wealth comes from the ESOP plan, as we've seen from HDFC and the other people, HDFC, AMC, the IPO and the fund manager made a ton of money, you know, all that stuff. So we've seen that. And we know that the ultimate success, and that's why we built Quantum as a partnership, right? We always, I always told everyone to join that, look, I will not give you shares today because shares are a liability till we start making money, but I'll make sure that you all get shares. And I've kind of moved in that direction and done so since a long, long time. So that's the sadness. The failure of Equity Master e-broking, which deserves an expose of HDFC Bank and Aditya Puri. You know, that's a 60-minute episode by itself. That was an absolute total sadness. The complete ineffectiveness of a group like HDFC to make good on contracts that they had signed. And, you know, to ask me a question or to make a statement, which was basically, you know, banya ka hisab kitab hai sort of thing, like money matters more than my word or my my signed document. You know, those were sadnesses. They're big sadnesses. But then, you know, it's also growing up. It's also realizing that what Dr. Manmohan Singh said, investment is an act of faith. And there are some people that you should not have faith in. There are some entities that, you know, you can have some faith in, but not a lot, not all your faith in. You know, which, so I think there's, those are sadnesses. And it's a reflection of our world where, you know, market cap dominates everything that you gauge about a person or you gauge about a company. You know, and to me, market cap is, you know, again, I'm a huge believer in John Bogle, you know, what Vanguard has built more than Warren Buffett, more than anyone else. No longer, he's no longer alive, Mr. John Bogle. But, you know, Vanguard is a group that, you know, I kind of look up to in many ways. And the teams that work there and the teams who used to work there. And I still meet once in a while. I've had the privilege and honor of working with them, and I enjoy meeting them because they have certain principles that they stand for. And, you know, they're, again, it's also a generational thing that what Subbu and you and I started, can the next generation of quantum chieftains keep up with that principled effort that we've got and be successful? And you've been successful, but be more successful than us. Subbu's been successful, but be more successful than Subbu. Mm-hmm. That's the trick. That's a wait and see.
Yeah.
So that keeps me awake at night in some sense. Mm-hmm. I worry about that. I don't worry, kind of note the fact in some sense. And then on a personal basis is, you know, I've tried to retire from quantum many times. It's my third effort. So I absolutely love everything that has been built. I love what, you know, I may not like the aggressiveness of your marketing, which is taught by Agora, wonderful, supportive JV partners. And we would not be without them, you know, where we are today, Equity Master, without their help and guidance, of course. So, you know, I try to retire and try to step out of everything and told you I'll write an honest truth and kind of want to even get out of that and do that. But, you know, the last few years, a lot of my friends have been telling me, Ajit, you're doing a disservice to others by stepping back and stepping out. Not that the others are not good. Let the others run the company. Mm-hmm. You still share your thoughts. You still share your mind. You still talk. And that's where when you asked me, will you do a podcast? I said, I'd love to do it. So, you know, locked up for all these years, would love to talk about, you know, things. And yeah, so I think that, you know, I you know, I'm spending a lot of time on the NGO space. We did that, as you know, 20 years ago, we started a database like Equity Master for NGOs. And we've built what I think is a fantastic, easy solution for an individual to give 5 rupees, 10 rupees, 100 rupees, 10,000 rupees to an NGO, just going on the, and I'll give a plug in here, helpatngo.com website, look for the Hingo, H-Y-N-G-O button. And the thesis is, did you Hingo today? So did you Google today? Did you eat food today? Did you Hingo today? Did you do that one small act of goodness for someone? You choose what that someone is, whether it's a woman who wants to, you know, go back to school, a child who is starting a school career, someone who's out to get food, whatever that goodness is, whichever part of India, we'll try to help you, you know, match your money and your kind action with their need through the Did Your Hingo. So those sort of things excite me. You know, I just came out of a meeting with a very well-known foundation, and they were talking about, you know, how they would love to support, you know, sort of democratic efforts, freedom of press efforts, NGO efforts, not just democracy, but, you know, NGO efforts, how to make it. And that's what we built Helper NGO for. Yeah. And so when I told them about Helper NGO, they said, oh my God, you did this, like started this 20 years ago. Wow. You know, but again, that's a bit like the mainstream quantum companies. Yeah. A thesis, you know, yet to be proven to a sustainable enterprise that can stand on its own 2 feet in some sense and do good service for, so you know, for the donors and as Equity Master is doing good service for the subscribers.
Yeah. So the thesis has worked in the lab on a small scale. And now it needs to work much larger scale.
It's also worked outside the lab.
Outside, yeah. Larger lab.
Yeah.
The lab being a metaphor for a small portion of the pot.
It's not gone national, right? We're not a nationally well-known brand. You know, if you're 21 years old or 25 years old, you work for Infosys, you work for TCS, you work for whoever you work for, you know, you enter their campus, your salary check is on from which bank? HDFC Bank, ICICI Bank, or State Bank of India. You go to the campus, you get an ATM. What do you see? Logo of HDFC Bank and ICICI Bank of India. And, you know, maybe Kotak and whatever. You'll see a few of those, right? But you won't see Quantum. You won't see Quantum.
You won't see Equity.
And, you know, people have told us, and you've heard this, that they respect us more than they respect many of the names.
I've heard that many times, yes.
You've heard that many times.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
But they don't see us.
Yeah.
So they're seeing the less respected people as per their own confession, as per their own experience. That's a sadness. You know, that's kind of, okay, you know, how do you better? So I would not say we're in the lab. We're out of the lab.
Yeah.
We're just not on everyone's, you know, hand phone, everyone's mobile, everyone's laptop, where we should be.
Yeah, that's the mission. So we're on
that's
it.
The mission. Go for it.
Okay, so we are wrapping up this podcast. So this is a question I've historically asked you whenever I've spoken to you and, you know, recorded an interview or a podcast. How do you see Okay, yeah. Let me ask the other question first. How does India look from the outside? When you are meeting people, you're talking to people across the world, you're always on a plane. So wherever you are, where all those flags we spoke of, how does India look from the outside?
So, you know, what you said earlier on touched me a bit. Mm-hmm. You said, I left you a note because you're always traveling. Right? Mm-hmm. Because I was always traveling. And again, you said that. I have spent, you know, from 1990, I have spent much of my life traveling outside India, marketing India. Mm-hmm. And it so happened that in my personal life, I got married. And of course, A, I moved to Florida. So I went there to learn. Mm-hmm. So that the learning could be imbibed and then taught back to the team in India. Mm-hmm. But I got married while I was overseas. My children live outside India. They study, work, whatever, outside India now. Mm-hmm. So obviously, I want to be close to them. So there's a reason I'm outside India now. It's not for work, because I'm not working that much. Mm-hmm. I'm retired, right? but I'm here primarily to be with them because I traveled a lot. So much as I didn't spend enough time with you, physically face-to-face in a room, physically face-to-face room with Subbu and so many of our quantum colleagues.
Yep.
So I've been working from a plane, working from home in that sense, you know, for a long time. And working on through a laptop, through Skype, or through mobile phones, or through, remember those callback services we used to have? Callback before mobile phones were so cheap, we used to have callback. You dialed a number, and that number gave you back a ringtone, and then you could dial anywhere in the world for like 10 cents a minute, as opposed to $3 a minute. You know, I still have a callback account somewhere on the other. You know, I'm probably still paying some exorbitant credit card fee to that company. It was called Callback with a K. I remember that very well.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so, you know, I was in touch with everyone, and I'd fly to India a lot every month. Was out there, wash your clothes, you know, get to eat great home food, sleep comfortably, take the fresh set of PowerPoints, and then take a plane and go out again. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we always travel economy wherever we go. Mm-hmm. So just go out on the road, travel. So your question was about
how
does India look? So in all my travels, I see India from two sets of eyes of the external world. Those who are investors and those who just read or are socially interacting with India, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the socially interacting with India doesn't look very good now because the news flow in India, right from whether you may agree or not on Democrats, lack of secularism, all of that, and then the Ukraine lack of support, if you will, for the condemnation of specifically naming Russia, you know, those are current sort of negatives in some sense from an audience that is not an investor audience, that is just reading India and watching news through as such. Now, you can push back and you can ask what about, and you can do a whole bunch of things. To give an example, I did not realize this until quite recently, that in the UK Parliament, the Church of England is guaranteed 16 seats in Parliament. 1/6, right? So is the UK a secular country? No, probably not. So, you know, how dare they talk about our secularism? Well, the difference is India has a constitution that doesn't talk about God, that doesn't talk about Jesus or about Allah or about whoever, Jude or whatever. It doesn't talk about any, you know, God. It talks about the principles of mankind or, and in this case, also womankind in some sense, right? And the principles that were there, and of course, the word secularism was put in by Mrs. Gandhi in 1977. So even that secularism was not there per se, but the principles of freedom of expression and speech and following your own power was always there. Mm-hmm. So there's a concern, right or wrong, you may fight about it and argue about it. There's a concern in the Western world that India is kind of losing its way on that, or there are some steps that don't look very encouraging. From the investor's perspective, I see people looking at India more closely today because of what's happened in China. So for 20, 30 years, while India was this rising, you know, we've always seen these covers of the elephant becoming a tiger from The Economist and cage tiger and cage this and all that stuff. So that narrative, that India's bureaucracy is holding it back, policy making is unclear, elections and politicians holding it back, blah, blah, blah. So I think there now, the Western world has suddenly realized, or the investment world has suddenly realized, whether from Japan or anywhere, that China is not that solid a destination. Mm-hmm. And we should have a larger look and larger allocation to India. So in the emerging market indices that we referred to earlier, in the MSCI indices, for example, China had a weight of 30% or something. Mm-hmm. And India had a weight of 10 or something, like a one-third that of China. So that there'll be a rebalancing of that. And if people begin to mimic, because if I'm an emerging market investor or a global investor, my board of trustees, my bosses of my investment performance will gauge me on how I've done against benchmarks. Yeah. So if the benchmark is weighted towards China and I start investing in India, I'm taking an active bet. Mm-hmm. And if mm-hmm. I'm wrong, I'll get sacked and lose my job and my bonus and my salary and my cushy life. So mm-hmm. you tend to hug the benchmark, right?
Yep.
So if the benchmarks change, India will automatically get more weight because India will get a higher weight compared to China. So I think that's the first thing from a portfolio perspective. And I think from a multinational perspective, when SARS happened in March 2003, mm-hmm. you didn't ask me where I was then, another big important date, the first pandemic. When SARS happened, I think I wrote about this on Equity Master. If you did a map of the world, the countries that were not affected were those that were not trading with the world. So India had, I think, two or three cases. Some guy had come from Hong Kong or something, got COVID, got SARS in South India or Chennai or somewhere. I don't know where it was. But India was not that impacted. People were not dying from SARS in India.
Mm-hmm.
And multinationals were looking for an alternative source of supply. And they did come to India, but not big enough. Because India was still slow. They went to Vietnam, they went to Bangladesh, they went to Thailand. They went to other places to replace China as mm-hmm. a source of supply. And I think now with what's happened in this phase of the problems with the Chinese government and with sort of policy making in China, I think people are very serious looking at India. Mm-hmm. Very, very serious. So I think India's on a fantastic wicket. And that's why I'm very optimistic. Very, mm-hmm. very optimistic on India's future as an investment destination. I hope that the government, as I indicated, the finance minister and everyone is doing good stuff. And I really hope that the government focuses more on this opportunity rather than do I need to polarize the population to win votes in the next election opportunity? Because that is a choice that India has. In Turkey, mm-hmm. Erdogan mm-hmm. actually made a choice. And he was supported by the EU to become the president in 2011-12, I forget the years now.
Mm-hmm.
In 5 years, he was the most distrusted person in EU. Even mm-hmm. today, when Sweden and Finland want to join NATO,
yeah,
he's saying, in Sweden and Germany, you have people who want Kurdish independence.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine if now India says you have people who want Kashmir independence or Bombay's independence or Goa's independence or South India, whatever independence, right? And so I'm not going to join. I'm not going to buy arms. I'm not going to do business with you. But he's doing that right now.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the most distrusted EU person, a person among EU leadership, followed very closely by what's happening in Hungary and Poland. But he's the most distrusted. And he took a conscious decision, as have the leaders of Hungary and Poland, that the popular moods and popular messaging matters more, much more than economic success. So mm-hmm. please urge all readers to look at the graph of the Turkish lira
mm-hmm.
and look at the graph of the Indian rupee. And you see how blessed we are to be in India. And of course, Sri Lanka had a big problem for other reasons and not to be in Turkey. But we have governments that tend to be similar to Poland, Hungary, and Turkey. Mm-hmm. Government policy making at the federal central level. States are different by and large. So that's a danger point. And that's the two eyes you look at India, two sets of eyes you look at. The social mm-hmm. equation, which is not so great, and the business or investment opportunity, which is fantastic. And I just pray that we, you know, we've had so many chances in our evolution as a country. We're still mm-hmm. a young country. But, you know, with the 1.4 billion people, you don't have a lot of time. You have mm-hmm. to get the economics right. You have to get the economy moving. You have to get wealth creation. Not talking about distribution of wealth where it only goes to the rich, but you mm-hmm. have to have an engine that works for everyone. And I think this is, to me, India's moment is here yet again for us to grab and ride, or for us to lose and just remain a thesis in a lab.
Wonderful. On that note, Rajit, thank you very much for coming on as a guest on the Investor Hour.
Thank you, Rahul. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this effort. Thank you so much.
Great. Wonderful.
Thank you for listening to the Investor Hour. I'm very excited to hear what you have to say about this episode or the podcast in general. Be sure to write to me at info@equitymaster.com. That's info@equitymaster.com. Thank you once again, and see you at the next edition of the Investor Hour.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.